For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
Okay, so this is the last week in our winter series, our study in the book of Exodus, and we're going to take a look at chapter 19 tonight, and I want to just give you a little bit of background, especially if you're new or haven't been here for a little while. We've been studying the book of Exodus, and we've been studying it from the perspective of asking ourselves the question, what does God say about himself? You know, everyone's got an opinion about who God is and what God's about and so forth. But really, at the end of the day, one opinion's no better than any other unless one of those opinions happens to be God himself. And that, of course, is the claim of the Bible, that God is personal and that God speaks and that God has spoken and that God has acted in history, therefore providing us a real basis to say there is a reason for us to know things about God, to know who God is and to know what God's will and God's purpose for our life is. And we have been tracing out this idea of how God has revealed himself and what Exodus has to say about who this God is. Now tonight, I want to approach it from slightly a different perspective. Namely, we want to ask the question, okay, given we've studied for 13 weeks now on what is God all about, we want to ask the question, what does it mean for us then to be the people of God? How do we respond to who God is and what's God's purpose for us as a body? And this comes from Exodus chapter 19 and verse 6, where this same issue is put forth to the Israelites. It says in Exodus 19, exactly 3 months after Israel had left Egypt, they came to the Sinai wilderness. And the Lord called to Moses from the mountain, saying, thus you shall say to the house of Jacob, the sons of Israel, you saw what I did to the Egyptians and how I bore you on eagle's wings and brought you to me. Now then, if you indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, then you shall be my own possession among all the peoples, for all the earth is mine, and you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words which you are to speak to Israel. Okay, so this is kind of like God coming together and saying, okay, you know what I've been about. Now it's time for us to talk about you, Israel, and what you're to be about. And so this is our text for tonight. I want us to look at verse 4 to begin with, where he says, you saw what I did to the Egyptians and how I bore you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. That is a real summary of everything that's happened in the book of Exodus up to this point. And what we have seen is that through God freeing Israel from their bondage to the Egyptians, that he has revealed who he is. That Exodus shows us God's true nature and God's intent for humanity. And so, for instance, we started our study in Exodus 3, the story of the burning bush, where God first appears to Moses. And he says, Moses, I am Yahweh, God, and I am the God of your forefathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. So he's a personal God. He's a God of history. He is about the work of effecting his purpose for his humanity. And he has chosen these people. He's chosen Israel as the vehicle through whom he is going to accomplish his purpose. And then through all of the chapters of Exodus up to this point, he has shown us various facets of who he is. And so he approaches Pharaoh and in the plague narratives, and he is the God of justice. And it's just not okay with God that human beings brutalize other human beings, enslave other human beings, and God is through a succession of events urging the Pharaoh and urging the Egyptians to do what God intends, which is that these people should live free and should go their own way. God is just. God is merciful. The other side of his justice. The fact is that while Humanity is guilty before God, and we stand before a righteous God. He has provided a substitute, and that's the story of the Passover, that it is possible for us to escape the sure sentence of eternal separation from God, the judgment of God, not because of the things that we might do for ourselves, but for what he has provided in the Passover, the death of the innocent on the part of the guilty. We've seen the power of God as God parted the Red Sea and allowed the children of Israel to go through the Red Sea and into the Sinai Desert. We've seen that God is a God who leads through the column of fire and the cloud, day and night. That God is leading his people, and God's intent is to lead our lives as well. And out in the desert, he doesn't just leave them to eat sand, but he provides for them every day manna, this stuff that whenever they ate it, they would have all their health needs met. Water, he provides supernaturally through the rock. And so through each of the little sequences of this narrative, we have seen God advancing forth, not just in some theoretical way, but in the context of what he has actually done in history, he has demonstrated, I am this kind of God. And so this is a pretty cool picture. And God also displays his purposes for humankind. And in this sense, we have to understand that Exodus falls in a broad pattern of what God is going to reveal in the future, and he has already revealed in the past. When God first approached Moses, remember, as I said a moment ago, he says, I'm the God of Abraham, your father, and of Jacob, and so forth. And I've been working with people now for 500 years in history. And what God is doing then with Israel is nothing more than building on the foundation that he had already laid in previous generations. And the story of the Exodus, at bottom line, is the story of God's faithfulness in fulfilling the promise that he made to Abraham all the way back in Genesis chapter 12, where he says, Abraham, I am going to make you a great nation. And now, in Exodus, this is the moment of their national birth. They've been released from their slave identity, and they have taken on the mantle of nationhood. And so God's faithful to that. And he says, I will bless you, Abraham, and I will make your name great. And so he says, you shall be a blessing, and in you all of the families of the earth shall be blessed. And so this really gets at what God's purpose for his people has been from the very beginning. Look at the construction there. I'm going to bless you. Why? Well, so that you can in turn be a blessing to others. In fact, that you can be a blessing to the whole world. And there's a principle here that we'll be needing to talk about here tonight, that God does bless his people, that God does protect, that God does lead, all of these things that we have seen already, not because God's people are an end to themselves, but that because that we are God's vehicle for the broader work that he wants to accomplish, not just for us, but for all of humanity. And so there's a special people with a special purpose. And tonight we want to talk about how Exodus 19 gets at the special purpose to which God has called his people, not just way back in the time of Moses in the 15th century BC, but also that same God with the same purpose today through us. Let's just talk for a second about what kind of people Israel is. He says, I bore you up on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. What kind of people are these? They're free people. That's who they are. Freedom. And the whole message of the Bible is that God wants to make us free. And you're sitting here in America saying, well, I live in the land of the free, in the home of the brave. I don't need to be liberated. But the Bible's message is, you know, yes, there are some people who need to be freed from political captivity. But everyone needs to be liberated from a deeper form of bondage. Namely, the bondage to our own sinful nature, our own fallen selves. That you and I, all of us, all of humanity share the same problem. That we're alienated from God. And that we think maybe in our alienation and that opportunity our freedom gives us, to chart our own path, to do our own thing, to in essence be our own God, that that's real freedom. That's true freedom. You know, no regrets. No responsibilities to anyone but myself. But that's not freedom. And that leads to, because we can only act in the world that God has made. And God did not make us to act independently of a relationship with Him. And so through our freedom, we have pushed ourselves, our boat, right up there on the reef. And we're stranded and we're stuck. And some of us really sense this about our own lives, even as we sit here tonight. Others of us know this more maybe from a theological point of view or something like that. But this is the Bible's picture. We are enslaved to a sinful nature that is in rebellion against God and that ultimately stands under His judgment. It's not a pretty picture. But the good news is that God is a God of liberation. And God desires to free us from our bondage to our own sinful nature, our own selfishness, our own self-destructive way of living. And He wants to restore us into a relationship with Him. And He's provided the means in His Son, Jesus Christ, to do just that. And we're going to talk about that more in just a few minutes. But that's who these people are. They're in right standing with God. They're the objects of God's liberating power. And now God then turns the lens on them to engage this question of what kind of people He's calling on them to be. He says, now then, verse 5, if indeed you obey my voice, then you shall be my possession on the earth. And so I just want to introduce us to the implication of being the people of God. And look at the language that God uses here. If, then. Think about that. It's a conditional statement, isn't it? If you do such and so, then this and that is going to be the effect. And now, you know, some of us might be shaking our heads here and saying, that sounds like a bait and switch. You know, up to this point, it's been all about God and what God's going to do and what God has done. And he's freed these people. Now He brings them out in the desert and He says, there are some expectations I have of you as well. What are those expectations? What's the nature of this conditional statement? What's really at stake? What's on the line when He says, if you obey my voice, then you shall be my people, my possession, and so forth. What does He mean? Well, one thing we know is that it doesn't have anything to do with personal acceptance. See, God's going to go in the very next chapter, chapter 20 of the book of Exodus, and pretty much right on through the book of Leviticus, which is next, and Deuteronomy, the fifth book of the Old Testament. It's all about the law. And God lays out the thou shalts and the thou shalt nots. And through the years, as people have read, the 613 laws that make up this very complex legal system, they have thought to themselves, well, what he's saying is, if we blow it and we break the law and we do the wrong thing, then we're no longer God's person. That God's going to, you know, get us. That while we were freed, now we're back to square one again. And of course, this is the teaching of religion. Religion is a system of legal principles, of behaviors. And if we keep our nose clean and we do the right thing and we follow the rules, then we don't have a beef with God. But if we get out of line and we do the wrong thing, boom, there's a problem right there. And God will reject us just as easily as He seemed to have accepted us. But that's really not true at all, because the law, this condition that he's putting out here, has absolutely nothing to do with how an individual stands before God. And it's very important that we understand this. God does not enter into a legalistic relationship, a performance-based relationship with us in order for us to earn his acceptance. In fact, our inability to follow the law as individuals is assumed by the law. How do we know that? Well, because there's a whole sacrificial system that says, you know, God is providing a sacrifice to atone, to pay for your sin. And this is something that goes on throughout Israel's national life, and the opportunity is always there for an individual to come and offer sacrifice and saying, basically, you know, I'm guilty, God, and I can't pay the debt I owe you, but this substitute will pay that debt for me. And God never treats his people on the basis of anything other than grace, what God has provided, which we cannot earn ourselves. And similarly, it's important for us to understand in this conditional statement that is given here, that he's referring here to not the individual standing before God, but the nations standing before the purpose that God gave them. And I think this will become very apparent as we get into our study. And he's saying, if you want to accomplish the purpose that I have called you for, then you will need to respond to me, and you will need to structure your national life around the laws that are established in the law of Moses. And so it's fulfilling Israel's role as a blessing to the world that really the law of Moses is all about. It begins with a picture of who God is, and the fact that he is the true ruler, and it is our obligation to subordinate our lives to him. And then a moral framework for how we put the real interests and needs of the others before ourselves. That's basically the Ten Commandments. And then it moves on from there to a legal system of how civil society ought to operate in under justice, with revolutionary ideas like due process of law and things like that that were largely unheard of in the ancient world. And then a set of ritual laws that explain what does it mean for guilty people to be able to interact with God. And so it's when Israel, as a consensus, lives outside of this design that God then withholds his protection from Israel, his blessing upon Israel, and they cease to be the blessing to the rest of the world that God intended for them to be. They forfeit the privilege of representing God in the world. And that's really what's at stake in this conditional statement right here. And Israel blew it over and over and over in their history. And never does God say, I've rejected my people. My promise remains. But this generation who departs from observing the heart of my law withdrawing my gift to them, their privilege of being my representatives on the earth, of living under my blessing and protection, and he carts them off into captivity. Let's talk about then, okay, it's not the issue of personal acceptance before God that's at stake, but what is at stake as we respond to God as he lays this out. Three things God puts out here about what does it mean for us as a people. You know, what kind of people should we be? He says, first, you know, Israel, you are my possession. And there's, so there's something kind of beautiful about that, that God delights in his children. He loves his children. He loves you and me, believe it or not. And so he is able, he's willing, he's able to look at us as his own treasure, his own jewel, as it were. And some older translations actually translate it treasure, not possession, and I think that's closer to the issue here. But look how the psalmist then reflects on this gift that God gives us of being his treasure, of being his own possession. He says, God, be gracious to us and bless us and cause his face to shine upon us, that your way may be known on the earth, your salvation among all nations. God, bless us that the ends of the earth may honor him. Now, think about what's being said here. God, we're praying that you bless us as you intend because we are your children. We are your possession. But we realize that there's a reason why you want to bless us, and it has something to do with the broader swath of humanity and not just ourselves. And so, very much echoing the whole thought world of Exodus 19 and the entire Old Testament, the psalmist says, we are asking you, God, to bless us so that, what? So that the ends of the earth may know what you are about. And so we want to place ourselves in a place where we can receive your blessing, God, because it's through that you're going to get your message out to the rest of the world. God blesses us so that we can be a blessing. That's the point. That's always God's point about what kind of people are we to be given who God is. We saw that as early as Abraham in 2000 BC. He's going to raise up this great nation so that he can bless the world. And he reminds Israel throughout their history, I'm blessing you so that you can be a blessing to others. How has God blessed your life? You know, if you have a relationship with God through Christ, every one of us has a story to tell. Every one of us are recipients of God's mercy and God's goodness. Every one of us are people who have been given great things by God, not because we deserve them, but because God is gracious and God is generous. You know, maybe you're one of these cup half empty kind of folks. Maybe you're one of these cup completely empty type folks. Maybe you just can't even train your mind to think outside of the negativity that you have habitually learned to interpret your life experience through. I struggle with that. Some of you do too. I know you do. And God is here saying, you know, that's just such BS. That God has been very, very good to you. And yes, your situation may be very difficult. Let's be realistic. But God's still God. God's at work. And you've got a story to tell about God's goodness. And he has blessed you no matter what your circumstance is. And you've got a story to tell. We were just hanging out last night with some friends who've gone through some excruciatingly difficult times in their life. But through those difficult times, God has shaped a marriage of deep trust and respect and effectiveness such that they had never had before. They've got a story to tell. You've got a story to tell. And I think, you know, the cool things that God does for his people is one of the best kept secrets in the world. Because you're keeping it a secret, and I am. You know, the world looks around at God's people and begins to form opinions about God. And what I think people don't get the impression of by the witness of God's people is just how good God is, how generous God is with his blessing in our lives. What a light this is to people when you are just honest to say, you know, God has been so gracious to me. I just want to tell you about how he's been at work really putting the pieces of my broken marriage together. How he has really provided me the ability to move beyond what's comfortable, to love difficult people in my life and to create real friendships and allies with them. How to deal with the difficulties of raising children in a very hostile climate as far as really grounding them in stuff that's good for them in terms of their values, in terms of their spiritual outlook and so forth. God's been good to me. And I just want you to know that. In case you were wondering, can you do that? Oh, I think you can. I think we all can do that. It's not that hard. It just takes a heart of gratitude to be able to pull our heads out of the muckety muck and say, man, I just want you to know that God's good. That can be done. How will you share the wealth that God has given to you? Who will benefit? Say, God's blessed you so that you can be a blessing. Who are the people in your life then that God wants to benefit through the work that he's doing for you? And I think here it would be very helpful for us to be, you know, specific about that in our own minds. I've got friends who live in real darkness. They don't have much hope in their life. They're not driven by meaningful, purposeful things. They don't know God. God has stationed me in proximity to them for the very purpose of my ability to share with them in an open way about how cool it is to have God in my life. That was God's purpose for Israel. He blessed them so that they could be a blessing to the nations. As Israel responds to God and experiences God's blessing and God's protection, then the word gets out. Israel's got something real going with God. That was God's intent. And God has an intent for the blessing that he gives to you. Who are we going to allow to benefit from the good things that God has given to us? Our intellect, our time, our financial resources, the experience of what he has accomplished in our own hearts. It's not enough to have some vague sense that he blesses me so that I can be a blessing. We need to have some teeth on that. Lord, who are those with whom I can share this incredible thing that you're a good God? My possession. And he says then, secondly, what kind of purpose are we to have as a people that we are? He says, a kingdom of priests. A people of kings and priests, as it says in other translations. It kind of captures the same idea. And now we are really moving into a very important and deep area of the significance of this Exodus 19 narrative. And I want to just, by way of overview, paint a picture for you that we're not going to be able to get into all the details tonight because it's just, there's way too much. But I want us to understand the general framework of something that is very cool that relates to this idea that God's people, Israel, is a kingdom of priests. What is a priest? A priest is an intercessor between God and humanity. That's their job. They offer up sacrifices. They help the people learn how that we're going to approach God. Because we can't just kind of strut into God's presence and like, here I am, because the bug zapper goes up and we're fried because we're not like God. We need an intercessor between ourselves and him. And that's what a priest is. And God is saying of Israel that you are a nation, a kingdom of priests, of intercessors on behalf of the lost humanity. And that means two things. One is that for Israel, this idea of being a kingdom of priests is really at the foundation, the cornerstone of their future hope for Messiah, who is the coming priest king, the one who in his own life and in what he accomplishes really accomplishes Israel's purpose as a nation of priests. And so let me just define this here, because I think it's really important that we're going to illustrate that Israel, understanding their intermediary role between a lost humanity and a just God, means that they are looking forward to a time where God would send his Messiah to fulfill the priestly purpose for Israel by being both a priest and sacrifice for the nations and by establishing his kingdom on the earth. And that's kind of a mouthful, I realize that. But if we're to understand the whole Old Testament message, it really comes down to this, that God has called a people of king priests in anticipation that he would send an individual who identifies himself fully with Israel, who truly is the king and the priest, and thus satisfying Israel's national charter, their purpose for why God called them to be the ultimate priest, to negotiate between man and God and to establish his kingship on the earth. One of the passages that makes this extremely clear is Zechariah chapter 6 and verse 13. And Zechariah here says that God's servant, the Messiah. And in the context, there's absolutely no doubt about it. He's talking about the coming Messiah, who he calls the branch of David, a technical term used for the Messiah in the Old Testament. And he says that this Messiah will build the temple of the Lord, and he will bear the honor and sit and rule on his throne. Thus, he will be a priest on his throne. And the council of peace will be between the two offices. Now, of the 12 tribes of Israel, there are two important tribes. One is the priestly tribe, the tribe of Levi. And the other is the kingly tribe, the tribe of Judah. And what Zechariah is prophesying here, which is in keeping with our passage here in Exodus 19 and the broader testimony of the Old Testament, is that God will send his Messiah into the world who is both a priest and a king. And therefore, bringing this idea of God's rule and access to God together in one man, in one individual. And so the heart of the complex prophecies of the Messiah in the Old Testament is uniquely filled by Jesus Christ himself. And, you know, I've been a Christian for many years at this stage of the game, 30 years now. And I've really thought about a lot. Not just why did I become a Christian to begin with, but why would I continue on in my faith and base what I'm really all about on this? You ever asked yourself a question like that? You know, because our up and down experience is not a very good base to say this is what I'm really all about in my life. We need a real rock solid foundation. And I am here tonight, and I'm talking to you tonight, more than any other reason, because of this incredible nature of Old Testament biblical revelation, that the whole story of the Old Testament uniquely, singularly, uniquely points to the priest, king, Messiah, Jesus of Nazareth. In a most remarkable and unusual way. And I want to just provide a very brief outline of how that is, that when Jesus says in Luke chapter 24, verse 44, I've come to fulfill the law, which is Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, and the prophets, which is most of the rest of the Old Testament, and the Psalms, he means that literally, that the whole Old Testament taken together paints an unmistakable vision of who God's Messiah is. And in the biography of Jesus, in the Gospels of the New Testament, what we see is Jesus doing that messianic task of identifying himself with Israel. And in very important ways, namely that he is God's son. We studied weeks ago from Exodus chapter 4, verse 22, that Israel is God's son. And all the loyalty that is involved with that and purpose. But the idea of the Son of God applies not just to Israel as a nation, but more specifically then to God's Messiah, the Son of God. Psalm chapter 2 makes this explicitly clear, that God's Messiah is the Son of God. And when we turn to the New Testament, we see that this is the terminology, this is the language that Jesus uses for himself. 43 times in the Gospels, Jesus is referred to as the Son of God. Well, that's really important because he's identifying himself with Israel. And the narrative of the Gospels really underscore this in a very important way. That just as Israel experienced an exodus, that God's Son also, in identifying with Israel and fulfilling Israel's purpose, also experiences an exodus. And so shortly after Jesus is born, his family flees to Egypt because of Herod's maniacal plan to exterminate the firstborn of Israel in hopes to wipe out his rival. And then on the death of Herod, his family returns. And Matthew says in Matthew chapter 3, he says, this was to fulfill Hosea 11:1, out of Egypt did I call my son. And Jesus then goes into the baptism narrative where he identifies with his people. And then what happens? God takes him out into the desert to be tested 40 days and 40 nights, an abbreviated version of the 40 years that Israel spends in the desert. At which time Jesus is drawing his life from the Father and citing Deuteronomy 8 and other passages in the law, that make it clear that Jesus is really walking through the national experience of Israel. After the temptation narrative, he goes to collect his disciples. How many disciples does he bring to himself? 12. As sort of a representation of the 12 tribes of Israel. And Jesus is at pains to show that I am the one who embodies the purpose that God had for Israel. In Luke 9 then, as Jesus is at the Mount of Transfiguration and he's preparing to go south to Jerusalem, south to the cross, he says, now is the time that I must begin my exodus. And so it's unmistakable that Jesus is clearly understanding that he is this one who embodies Israel's experience and who is this awaited Messiah. He is the king who comes to establish his kingdom. Like Zechariah says, the priest who sits on his throne and rules as king. And so the gospel writers are at great pains to demonstrate that Jesus is the rightful heir to the throne of David. That's what the genealogies in Luke and Matthew are there to establish. Jesus repeatedly says, I've come to establish my kingdom. No, it's not the political kingdom that you think it is. Not at this stage of the game. It's a spiritual kingdom of those who voluntarily entrust their being and their life to me. That's the kingdom of God. And I've come to establish that kingdom, and I am the king. And then finally, the priestly function, where Jesus offers himself as both the priest and indeed the sacrifice itself. As the Old Testament envisions that all of humanity's sins would come to fall on an innocent man in Isaiah chapter 53. All of us like sheep have gone astray, all of us. But he made our guilt fall upon him. The one who dies in substitution for us. And Jesus says, I am the Lamb of God. And it is my purpose to take away the sins of the world. But I do it voluntarily. I offer my life. In that sense, he is the priest. He's not having his life just taken from him. He's offering it himself. And I will tell you, and again, this is just kind of a broad outline of the whole picture. But it is possible to read the entire Bible and see with great clarity that it all focuses specifically and uniquely on God's Messiah, the one who embodies Israel's purpose as a priest king. It's profound. And it's something that enables me to say, man, I am willing to gamble my whole life on this. Because it is so compelling, so convincing. And there's a second sort of application that Israel was to learn about what it means to be a kingdom of priests. In anticipation of the Messiah's coming, that Israel was to present God's message to the nations. God's mercy, God's love. And so we see narratives like the book of Jonah. Remember that story? The prophet who is called by God to go and speak to Nineveh, the great city, it says. And a city that in a generation after Jonah is going to come down and is going to obliterate the 10 northern tribes of Israel. These were rough customers. But God loved Nineveh. And God loved the Assyrians. And God called his prophet, his people, to go and speak of what God's all about. And that's why Jonah went exactly the opposite direction. Nineveh is to the north and to the east. He went to the south and to the west. And why did he do that? Because he wanted Nineveh to be judged by God. He wanted to take an enemy out of the way. But God wasn't interested in that. God was interested in seeing these lost people found. And so it's just very interesting how that narrative unfolds. And that's consistent with God's pattern of how he uses his people. He wants to communicate his mercy. And he does that through his people. And God's purpose for his people has not changed. And God's purpose for my life and for yours, for our life as a community together, is to express through our witness, through what we say, that God is merciful, that God is accessible, that God is calling on you to enter into a relationship with him through Jesus Christ. And God is calling us as a community, not just to speak that message with our words, but to live it out among one another and to live out the character of God, the goodness of God, the justice of God, as we care for those who don't have in the name of Christ. To be a witness of what God's all about because we have compassion like God has compassion. And that's God's charter to us as it was God's charter to Israel, a kingdom of priests. And then lastly, what kind of people are we supposed to be? He says, well, you're to be a holy nation. A holy nation. I stumble over that idea. I think that the word holy, in fact, is a misleading word and an unfortunate word. It comes both in its Hebrew and also in its, as translated into English, it has its very ancient roots, which really mean wholeness, W-H-O-L-E, not H-O-L-Y. That's literally what it means. It means to be whole. And he says, you're to be a nation of whole people as you subordinate yourself to my will for your life as it's revealed in the law. We think about holy in a little different terms, don't we? We think of a holier than thou, of moral superiority. And unfortunately, rather than the message of love and compassion and reconciliation that God calls his people to, what we are typically known for as the people of God is this very attitude, this moral superiority kind of idea that we like to get out there, that many people like to get out there, just basically say, you know, I'm not really like all the rest. I'm into God, and, you know, I just don't do the evil stuff. Wouldn't you like to be one of me? You know, when people are seeking God, this is a very important point. The first question in their minds is not, I'm sure that this is true, is the message true? It's not the first question. The first question in people's minds is, can I be one of them? Can I see myself being about what these people are about? It's just the way we function as human beings. Is it even a plausible thing for me to think about whether it's true? And this issue of being holy as being just a good moral person is exactly what the world around us does not want. Especially in the very narrow terms that is oftentimes presented in the name of Christ to the world around us. No, not interested. And you know, it's very interesting to go to other places in the world sometimes, like Europe, for instance, that has had a long-term Christian presence there, where it's just as though you're talking to a Martian when you talk about Christ. And the reason is because, you know, they believe that the church had its time, and it's not a plausible option. What it represented was its own self-aggrandizement, its own wealth, its own political interests, a narrow, repressive religious system that made priests the one who dispenses salvation one wafer at a time. No thanks. And there is a perception in our culture that we have cultivated, tragically, that Christianity is something other than what the Bible says it is. It's simply a a group of sinful people who have found forgiveness and reconciliation through Christ, and we're just wanting to live out, what does that mean to have God in my life? And that message doesn't get through. What gets through is morality. We're like morality salesmen. The world's not interested. And Paul says he anticipated this problem as well. And Paul says in 1 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 10, he says, I did not ask you to associate with immoral people. I did not ask you not to associate with immoral people of this world. Paul's saying, do you understand me? I'm not saying you're holier than thou and you avoid people that might contaminate you morally. So stay away from people who sin according to some narrow interpretation of what all that is, namely the things that you're not tempted to do, I suppose. I did not ask you not to associate with immoral people in this world. For then, he says, you would have to go out of the world. For what do I have to do with judging those outside the church, he says. And Paul envisions, and Paul led a movement of people that were outwardly mobile, that moved towards people in their situations, because Jesus did that. It was Jesus who was the friend of the sinner. He's the one that would hang with the prostitutes, the tax gatherers, the sick, the outcast, the downtrodden. He went after them. And God is saying to us, you know, being holy doesn't mean that we are somehow repulsed by the sinfulness of man. It means that we move towards people in their brokenness and in their need. To be holy is not to be morally superior. It is to be holy gods. That's really the issue. It's a lot easier to turn that into some kind of a external system of religious duties, of things that we don't do that demonstrate our piety or whatever. God is not for that. To be holy means that we are holy gods, that we're not holding back. You know, straddling the fence between living life for me and presenting myself fully to God is very painful and very ugly. Just create that picture in your mind. You straddle a fence and that post is going somewhere. Okay. And you know, there's a lot of people I know who kind of walk around like that. And it comes out as, you know, my Christian life is, you know, God, what do you want from me now? And I, you know, I've got my own thing to do, and I'll stick you in, you know, Sunday, I don't know. Or that sense, that deep sense of duty orientation, of resentment at the idea of presenting our whole lives to God. And this is where many of us are at in our Christian lives. We're not prepared to say that I'm unreservedly willing to present my whole being to God because I'm so much into keeping it for me. And that has just such an unedifying and very destructive process that brings about in our lives. We don't feel that sense of closeness to God. We've got an issue with God. And so we're living for reputation. We're living for the accolades of others. We're living for greater material comfort. We're living for all, you know, fill in the blank, and we all struggle with these things. And we come to those points where God is saying, look, you're just not going to be able to experience me in a deep way until you look at this barrier that is really keeping me from communicating my love for you and my purpose for your life and my goodness to you. And you need to set this thing aside. And God is calling on you to set it aside, whatever it is. And maybe it's bitterness and the unwillingness to forgive. Maybe it's all these other things that we want to just, you know, define ourselves by instead of being defined by being a child of God. And we are really in tension within ourselves And God is saying, man, give it up. Give it up. To be holy gods does not mean that we're perfect. It just means that we're saying in our hearts, I don't know what this looks like necessarily, God. Don't really know how this functions, but I am convinced that you're good. And I'm convinced that you're God. And so if I got those two pieces pegged down, I just want to offer myself to you. I want to present myself to you, as Paul says in Romans chapter 12 and verse 2. I just want to give who I am to you. I'm going to trust, God, that you will lead my life in a way that is pleasing and is a real blessing to me, and that it fits into your goodwill and your purpose for the world and for why you've called your people together to be a blessing to others. I just trust that you'll work out the details of that. And I'm just telling you, God, here, I'm yours. And I really believe that that's a decision of the will. That you know, many of us have made that kind of a decision. We've had to reaffirm that at various crossroads in our lives. And maybe we're at yet another crossroad here, and we just want to be able to come before God to say, I want to be wholly yours, God. I'm not sure what that means, but I trust you, and I believe that you are going to work this out in a way that has a revolutionary effect on my life, and through me, it's going to accomplish your purpose for your people to bless the world. So, I think this is a fitting place to kind of draw the line here. We have an awesome God. We have a God who created us to live in relationship with us, to experience his goodness in our lives. And he's calling on us then to say, why don't you be about me? Why don't you be about that? And when we agree together as a body of people that that's what we want to be about, man, really sweet stuff begins to happen. People around us sense that there's spiritual life and vitality, and we begin to see God at work in a just a terrific way. Why don't we spend a couple moments in prayer? Lord, just thanks, for the privilege of being your people. It is sort of a remarkable thing when I look around the room here at all the lives that have been led, and how different we are, and yet how at the core we have something that's just absolutely greater than any difference. We have your Spirit. And I pray, Lord, that you would help us to be bound together by your Spirit into common purpose, that we would understand that biblical principle that you've called us to experience your blessings so that we can be a blessing to others, that we are really, situated where we are in space and time because you love people who don't know what you're about. And God, just make it the driving passion of our hearts to be the kind of people who are moving towards a humanity that's just desperately lost without you. In Christ's name, amen.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted, but you may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.